I'd like to start with just sharing a remark or two, and then we're going to open up for questions. When you have a question, hold your hand up. I'm going to bring the mic to you so we can capture the question on the recording, not just the answers. You know, one of the things that stands out most from Hanan's talk is this idea of that there are two different narratives, and that the two narratives are very true, certainly in the eyes of those who hold to the narratives. The fact that they're competing with each other in so many different ways in terms of the land primarily, but in other ways as well, is where conflict arises. And it's trying to get into that space to work between the two peoples is really the most is the most challenging thing. You know, I think it's important to take religion into account. So much of peacemaking in our world today is at the political level. And as Hanan rightly said, that you know, whether there is a treaty signed or not, it is going to be a piece of paper with lines drawn on it and rules and laws marked out on it, laid on top of a region with the belief that peace has been established. And, you know, something may hold for 5 years, 10 years, 35 years, 40 years. But the problem is underneath it will remain all the unresolved problems, the lack of harmony and community between the peoples who live so close to each other. And that's really where I believe the faith traditions have an extremely large role to play. And that those who love God, those who believe we're called to love our neighbors, it is the place where we ought to be working, to be bringing people together, to be dealing with these walls of fear and suspicion and mistrust and stereotype and all these other things that are going on, that that's the place where we can work. And I believe that that is the place where the true peace, true reconciliation, and ultimately true community is going to be established, that it's not going to happen with a piece of paper. I think an historical example we can keep in mind that it works for me at least is the former Yugoslavia. And in essence, following the Second World War, there was a piece of paper put all over the top of all of these various little provinces and enclaves of people groups, and it said this is going to be the unified Slavic peoples, basically Yugoslavia. And it had a charismatic leader, Marshal Tito, for a while, and he was able to kind of hold things together, but he passed away. The collapse of the Soviet bloc takes place, and all of a sudden these latent struggles, animosities, hatreds just exploded, and we had a horrible scene, which came about in the 1990s. I think I would be sick if something like that were to happen in the Holy Land when I think of all those I've met on each side and the people I've come to love. And I think that is really the place where peacemakers need to be working, where there's plenty of room for more people to come into the midst of a conflict and trying to bring people together. And that's ultimately what I've felt led to do. It's what Hanan is feeling led to do, to step into that divide and find ways to take down these walls and build something special. The last thing I want to say is this: looking at the first half of the talk and the return of the people Israel to the land, you know, a part of the ministry I felt led to pursue is to really be an encouragement for the people Israel to rise up into the best of their faith tradition. That there's the return to the land. We have these competing narratives, but I believe the best way to bridge the narratives, I believe, is already existent in Torah, in the teachings of Torah. and the calling of the people of Israel to be a light for the Gentiles, a light to the nations, and being a people of justice and righteousness and loving kindness and compassion and faithfulness and shalom, peace, of more than just not killing each other, but wholeness, peace. And, you know, the more I look, the more I find there are all these bright lights. And I see there's great potential for the people of Israel to play an amazing role, that they're situated now in the land in a way in which they can have an incredible impact on the direction that this goes. And that, as I believe more people like Hanan, and you've heard, and some of you have met my friends Shaul and Myron and Nachum and people like this who are trying to do these things, we can see something amazing happen in the Holy Land and see these very different and differing faith traditions coming together and working together in a way that really ultimately gives great glory to God in the process. So I believe there is hope. I believe there is a solution in the sense that it's going to take a lot of hard work. It's going to take people working at the grassroots level and creating a movement that's bottom up that begins to transform things at a higher level. Those are just three thoughts I wanted to throw out before we start. Does anyone have any questions? All right, so Vic first, and we'll get to Eric next. Vic.
Teacher, thank you for coming. We welcome you, and we really want to commend you for your willingness to talk to the other people on the other side of the fence. Many of us take the scriptures very seriously. We read the scriptures as the state of Israel being a fulfillment of God's promises for the land, at least a partial fulfillment. And we also read scriptures that say that the land is also for the sojourners or for the foreigners, and that they too are to be protected under the laws of this state. And my question is, what awareness is there among the religious Jews, or what mindfulness is there of that duty to the sojourners, the foreigners, the others, even among the non-religious Jews, all who count on this as being God's fulfillment of a prophecy?
There's a lot I can say. Wow. Okay. So first I'll say a little bit from the point of view of Jewish law. Then I'll talk a little bit about, I guess, sociology. So if we open up the Torah, the five books of Moses, we find the category of the sojourner, and we find the category of the foreigner, or two different categories. As far as the foreigner goes, I really don't remember there being anything said about rights. But concerning the sojourner, certainly an awful lot is said. Now, who's the sojourner? It looks like the foreigner is someone who's just passing through from another country, another land, here today, gone tomorrow. The Torah mentions such a person, such a category, but doesn't seem to say too much about his or her rights. But the sojourner is the person who came from a foreign land and is staying for quite a while. And indeed, the Torah says many things about the sojourner, about safe, basically feeling, remembering that you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. You were persecuted there, and you know the heart of the sojourner. So you know how it feels to be alone without your support system in a foreign country. Treat him properly. It even says, "V'havta et ha'ger," you should love the sojourner. Okay, except for the fact that the Jewish law goes deeper and finds there are two different types of sojourners. I'm not saying that this is, I think it is almost explicit in the biblical text, but this is Jewish tradition, that most of the laws of the sojourner are applied to those who decide to sojourn forever. In modern religious language, it's called a convert. In modern religious language, it's called a convert. In other words, 70-80% of those laws of the sojourner in Jewish law apply to those who sojourn into Judaism, those who convert to Judaism. If anyone's interested in the terminology, the word sojourn in Hebrew is ger, someone who just comes to sojourn, and we call converts to Judaism ger, ger tzedek, a righteous sojourner. And like I said, about 70-80% of the laws that in which the Torah says the proper behavior towards the sojourner are applied to the convert. That a Jew is supposed to, for example, love the convert like a born Jew. Okay, but what about the other 20% of the statements concerning the sojourner? So there, in Jewish law, we have a category of the resident sojourner. And indeed, the resident sojourner deserves, according to the Torah, equal rights to the born Jew. And then the question is, who is a resident sojourner? How do you get yourself to the category of being a resident sojourner? You didn't know I was going to get into all this when you asked the question, right? You had no idea. When you want me to stop, just tell me. I'm kidding. I'm half done. In Jewish law, the resident sojourner is someone who has taken upon himself the seven Noahide laws. Ever heard of those? Okay, so I'll give you a class in Jewish theology. I love this. This is my real profession. I'm just a peacemaker on the side. Judaism has what you would call a dual covenant theory. Judaism doesn't believe that you have to be Jewish to be find favor in God's eyes. We believe there's a Jewish covenant and a non-Jewish covenant. If you're part of the Jewish covenant, if you're born Jewish, you have to keep the 613 commandments. If you're not Jewish, then we believe in the covenant of Noah. You say it also in English, right, Noah? From the time of the flood? And the seven laws that we call the seven laws of Noah are prohibition against idolatry, prohibition against murder, prohibition against thievery, prohibition against blasphemy, prohibition against illicit sexual relations, prohibition against cruelty to animals. That's six prohibitions, and the seventh is a positive as opposed to a prohibition. It's the obligation to set up courts of justice, live in a civil society. So then the question is, do Jews view Muslims, Palestinians, as upholding those seven laws? The answer is yes. Judaism views Islam as a religion that has accepted those seven laws, which means, is the end of my long answer to your short question, that yes, you're right. That in Judaism, Muslims are considered to be resident sojourners, and they deserve all the protections of the laws that Jewish law has vis-a-vis the resident sojourners. So how do we behave with such discrimination and distrust and persecution and hate of Arabs? History. History and reality. Right, Jews have experienced themselves as being persecuted for 1,800 years, whether in Christian countries or Muslim countries. And then, because of everything I talked about, Jews and Arabs have been at odds, right, at the end of a gun barrel for almost 100 years. All the nice things about religion, right, don't seem to come to the fore when you're talking about hatred and fear and the possibility that I'm going to lose my life. To put it in Jewish terms, all of the commandments are set aside when human life is in danger. Right, you all know that probably Jews are supposed to keep kosher. I'm not going to go and have a McDonald's. But if my life is in danger, if I'm going to starve, it's a commandment to go and have McDonald's. Well, all the more so when my life is in danger in a situation of war, all of the commandments are put aside. According to many rabbinic authorities today, we're in a state of war. And you know what? It's true. We're in a state of war. I'm commanded to behave with great understanding towards the resident sojourner, but I'm not commanded to behave with great understanding vis-a-vis the enemy who's sworn to kill me. And I don't say that out of hate, but many, many Jews are sworn to kill Arabs, and many very Arabs are sworn to kill Jews these days, and we're in a situation of war. So here we are with the very lofty religious commands of loving the resident sojourner, and then we have the situation of war, which you have to look out for your own soul, your own life, and that's also a religious commandment. And we have a conflict. I said too much, right?
Okay. I know they're not exactly parallel in their backgrounds, but a lot of your discussions kind of talked about the discrimination, the different laws Palestinians are under, different schools they're in. What kind of parallels do you think this has in America's civil rights movement? And do you guys draw parallels to that part of American history and the hatred? I mean, you obviously had groups, swearing to kill each other as well, Ku Klux Klan, Black Panthers. You know, you had that same kind of visceral hatred of each other. What kind of parallels are there, and what situations does it not apply?
Look, I'm going to tell you what I believe is true, and even if I'm thinking in my mind what I'm going to say, I don't know how it's going to sound. But the way I see things, it's different. It's very different. Because we are trying to defend ourselves. Let me give you an example. I'll make it real. One of John's friends in Israel, his name is Myron Joshua. I made contact with him a few months ago. I heard he was a peacemaker. I said, introduce me to people. I want to know what's going on. So he took me to a little Arab village that's in the area of Gush Etzion where I live. Now, let me explain to you. Gush Etzion, based on everything I said, is about 20 Jewish settlements. Some have 3,000 people, some have 5,000 people, some have 100 people. 20 Jewish settlements in an area that has, relatively speaking, very few Arabs in it. Very few means perhaps I don't even want to say numbers, but relatively speaking, very few Arabs in it. And here you have this tiny village called Hirbat Zakaria in the middle of Gush Etzion, between four big Jewish settlements that are flourishing and have a wonderful community life. You have a little Arab village there that I thought only has four houses, but it turned out it has like 20 houses in it, and about 100 people there, including little kids. Well, not that many families. 100 people is not a lot of people, including little kids, right? So I went with Myron to visit the Mukhtar, the head of this tiny village, to just get to know my neighbor, who lives right. He lives right smack in the middle. He's a little minority among thousands of Jews of these 20 Jewish settlements. And we had a wonderful conversation. And without any rancor, without any hate, he just told me, I'd love to have a roof that didn't leak. Why does he have a roof that leaks? Because he's not allowed to build a house, and according to the zoning laws, because his village doesn't exist. It's a village built in the middle of nowhere. It's all zoned for agriculture, and he has a village there that's grown up over the years. And the army has allowed him to build a house without a roof, just a tin corrugated roof. As long as there's no roof, it's not considered to be a house. But the minute he comes to waterproof his roof, the army comes and tears down his house. So he just said to me, without rancor, I'd love to have a house with a roof that didn't leak. I walked out of that meeting saying, he deserves a house with a roof that doesn't leak. And I said to my wife and my kids, this isn't fair. And actually the whole next day I went online to all these left-wing websites that are rallying for rights for the Palestinians. And I read that, I said, they're right. I really see that the zoning laws are being used to prevent them from building their village. It's not fair. And I said to a few of my friends in Alon Shvut, I couldn't keep it inside. I said, do you know about this? We live in these circumstances. It's right down the block. And someone said to me, someone that I really respect and someone who has a great heart, she said to me, if we allow him to build a house, then there'll be another house, there'll be another house. Suddenly there'll be a big Arab village in the middle of Gush Etzion. Next thing you know, there's no committee that decides who can move in and who lives there. There'll be Hamas there, and then there'll be firing, and then there'll be roadside bombs, then there'll be terrorists. So what do I say now? She's right. In other words, I am turning a blind eye to discrimination, because I, my society, my friends, my neighbors, my mayor, believe that we're at war. And that if we just can't allow a whole village to spring up of people who might tomorrow want to kill us. And it's not a theoretical concern. I mean, it's a real concern. So what do I do? How do I live with this? So it's not like the South in the 60s, 50s, 40s, 40s, 50s, 60s. It's not like the South. Here it's a real situation of danger to life, of war. Now, I don't like the situation, and I don't feel good with myself. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do.
You pray.
You pray.
Pray.
You're right.
And then follow up on what you're told as you listen in the journey.
One thing I would add is I know the Mukhtar in that village. His name is Muhammad Saad. And Muhammad said he doesn't want Hamas there either. He wants just enough homes for his own kids so they can live with their wives and be able to live together instead of having all of his kids having to move out to Beit Fajar or further, or Hebron, yeah. or Kahul, or one of the further places.
So challenge me. Tell me what to do.
So it's, you know, one
it's
thing
really hard.
One thing, Eric, I would say is when it comes to the civil rights movement, it's had a huge impact on Palestinian society. In fact, many of those who are very active in the peace movement today in Palestine came to where they are actually when they were in prison during the First Intifada, where they began to read the writings of Dr. King, read the writings of Gandhi, a variety of different authors. Many of them read the words of Jesus, and they said, this is who we need to become. So in that sense, it has had an impact on the conflict, that it's actually there's been a class of peacemakers rising up in Palestinian society due to the influence of the different civil rights movements. And I would say Palestinians will be much more quick to point to that example than Israelis would, just due to the circumstances. Scott.
Thanks, John. Rabbi Hanan, we really appreciate you coming, making us part of your Dallas itinerary here this week, and for your hospitality to John. When we sent him on these trips, we just really feel like he finds incredible hospitality from people like yourself, and we feel very much that, you know, there's a open doors where he's protected and cared for and valued for the gifts that he has. You and I are very close in age. I actually accused him of being younger than I am, and he's about 4 or 5 months older than I am. We both have gray in our beard, although your beard is much more impressive than mine.
Much more?
Much more impressive, your beard, than mine. And we both are teachers. Our passion is to teach. We're at a time in our life, both of us, where just from life cycle, reflection on life cycle, we care about things and values that are very different than we did when we were 30 years old. We look at the world differently. I assume you have children. I have children, adult children. I assume your children are adults. I assume you learn from them, even as they learn from you. And I do feel like we're at a time in our life where we have to step out in courage in the best of our traditions and believe that dry bones can still rise up. And there might be a dry bone picture here even for that very precious piece of land and for all the peoples that are in that land. There may be the possibility of a peace that can rise up if all the traditions work together. Now, our investment in Palestine right now is with John and with the teams that we send over there, but we make a very large investment. It's important for the people over there to know that a big part of our resources that we bring together are being channeled to do what we can do to create a more loving world over there, in a more open, caring community that's going to be multifaceted and that is complex. But I simply want to say I'm willing to join you, as John is joining you, in working with our narratives. We have different narratives, but also being open to find room to walk alongside of you with your narrative. If you will join me in reaching out to others who have narratives that are different than my own and commit yourself, as I will, to the best of our faith traditions, which call us to love, humility, service, to be open to learn from one another. So maybe this is more of a statement, simply to say I really appreciate you being here. I appreciate being able to expose the people here. I hope someday to sit in your living room and have tea with you and maybe something kosher. Okay?
It's all I have. You're invited, of course.
Hi. Thank you for coming. In my experience, people tend to distrust or dislike what they don't know. Something that they see is fundamentally different from who and what they are and what they believe in. I think the same has been true throughout my life when I've met people who came from the South who hated all blacks. And invariably, I discovered that they lived in communities where there were no blacks. So they didn't even know what it was that they were hating, other than it was something cultural and something that was expected of them. So I think what I would say to you and to your neighbor who was talking about what happens if we let them build the roof is that if you get to know them, you'll probably discover that they're not Hamas. They're not interested in that. They don't want that in their lives any more than you do. But they're fundamentally not that different from you. And it seems to me that a key to all of this is a better understanding of each other, of those narratives, and actually crossing the fence, shaking hands, meeting, getting to know, and realizing that there's way more in common than there is different. Kind of a speech, sorry about that. Wasn't really intending, but you'd ask the question. And I guess where I'm coming from is, what do you think can be done to get your friends to want to go meet other people and realize that maybe they're not so different than you are to begin with?
It's exactly that. It's friends talking to friends. I think that, as far as I know, my society and my neighborhood and my acquaintances, you can't just put a sign on the bulletin board who wants to go tomorrow on a field trip to Beit Zakaria down the road. It's a 5-minute walk. The radicals will be calling me on the phone the next day to take that sign down. It's a matter of talking to individuals and having them. That's exactly how I got to Beit Zakaria. I met this guy, Myron, and he said, I said, I want to meet people. He took me to Beit Zakaria. He took one person. And then I'll take one person and there'll be another person. I'll tell you that this might be interesting. The Palestinians, they live in villages and towns, and they shop within their villages and within their towns. Makes sense. The Israelis live in closed settlements, and we shop within the supermarkets that are in our closed settlements. About 20 years ago, a gas station was built on the main Jerusalem-Hebron highway, right, Jerusalem Hebron Highway, a gas station by a Jewish company that wasn't within a settlement. It was just out there in the middle of nowhere. You know what? Arabs started buying gas there. And Jews buy their gas also. So some things actually have contact with each other. Now, that's not so bad. It's only buying gas, only 5 minutes. But recently they built a supermarket at that intersection, a Jewish supermarket chain, and it's for Jews. But you know what? Palestinians started coming to buy there. It's not within a settlement. And now people are actually shopping together. And not only that, do you have the, how do you call it, cashiers? There's Jewish cashiers and there's Palestinian cashiers working in the same supermarket. Now, to you, this sounds like, of course there are. You know, this is really strange to us. And I've heard many of my neighbors say, we have to put an end to this. How could you have Jews and Palestinians working together in the same store? They might get to know each other, and the big fear is intermarriage. And most of my neighbors think it's a terrible thing, the supermarket. But whether you think it's a terrible thing or not, everyone shops there because the prices are lower. And now my wife even got to know some of the cashiers there. So that's, in a certain sense, that's part of a solution. It's a strange way to come to a solution. And there might be more things like this.
Well, I understand there are musical groups. I understand there is at least one musical group that is combining everybody together.
Uh-huh.
I can't tell you offhand. I heard this recently, but I can't tell you offhand the name of the group. But it's right there. And they're making music, important classical music, together.
Dee Dee, an answer just to throw in your question. I'm going to be speaking a lot about the phenomena of starting a movement this weekend on Sunday and how I've seen it actually just taking place and how to build momentum and how it can grow. So I'll share more about that this weekend. But, you know, it's amazing that, you know, when a few people say, you know, hey, it's okay. You know, the water's fine. It's not so cold. You try this. More and more people try. And when you start getting a critical mass of people doing something, others start jumping on board very quickly. You know, and then they don't want to be like, they want to get in before it looks like the not cool thing to do. You want to get in while it's still cool. And then more people get involved in it. They might not start out with the same ideological or ethical motivations or anything, but they start to begin to see that, hey, this is okay, this can happen. And a lot of that took place in the civil rights movement. And I think it has great potential over there as well, but I'll share more about that this weekend. So I'm encouraged by what I see. I know my sample size is very small compared to all of, as you're saying, Judea and Samaria is quite large, but it's got to start somewhere. Aura, and then Rick.
Nice to meet you, Rabbi. You're the first rabbi, and I'm probably the last rabbi I'll meet, so nice to meet you. My question is regarding where you stand and where the Palestinians stand. I'm wondering with the peace treaty, yes, we do have politics, just like you say back home, a lot of the things that we might find hard to understand, it is because of politics, it is because of history. The same is here, obviously, in the States as in any other country. So my question is, with the peace treaty being something pretty imminent, it's going to either happen or not happen. I know you mentioned that it's just a piece of paper, but in reality, how do Jews really feel that this might affect or might not affect their future? Palestinians, do you know any views of how they feel this might affect their future? It sounds like John said there is a lot of hope and a lot of movement in a lot of areas. I'm a firm believer, like Vic said, that prophecies are being fulfilled, that God is in control, and he's definitely creating movements and creating a lot of these events to happen for a bigger purpose that sometimes we don't quite understand. So my question to you is, what is your point of view as far as what Jews feel for what might come and what could possibly change if something is agreed to?
I just saw in Israeli news yesterday, I think it was, a backlash in which certain Israeli politicians spoke very disparagingly of John Kerry. Did anyone see that? And then other politicians apologized. So you ask yourself, Americans probably ask yourselves, why would Israeli politicians be angry and indignant with John Kerry? He's trying to help. But there's a deep sense among right-wing politicians, which means the people who represent my friends, my neighbors, my constituency, there's a deep sense that any peace treaty is going to be bad. Why is it going to be bad? Because the Arabs are going to continue to hate us and want to drive us into the sea, and the peace treaty is going to involve certain compromises which will in the end compromise Israel's security. So in the next war, it'll be harder to defend ourselves and we'll lose more of our young men. That's a very, very prevalent way of looking at things in the areas that I live in. I would say where I live, 90%, 95% of the people see peace treaty as equaling bad. There can't be anything good that would come of a peace treaty. Why? Because, again, because we know that the Arabs hate us, and the peace treaty is just going to make us give up land, it's going to give up make it harder to defend ourselves the next time. And it's giving in to evil. Again, I'm not saying what I believe. I don't really know what I believe. I see both sides. There's a lot of pessimism concerning any possible peace treaty, and the general feeling among my neighbors, again, there where I live, is that the best case scenario would be no peace treaty for as long as possible. Let's just maintain the status quo. Now, understand that the status quo, from an Israeli point of view, is very comfortable. It's very comfortable. From the Palestinian point of view, the status quo is a tragedy. There's a disparity here.
I'll just add, I'll speak for the Palestinians. That is true. They do see it as a tragedy. Palestinians would love to see something signed because it will begin to take off the pressure upon them of the occupation, the checkpoints, and so forth. And they're talking about rolling back the military presence in the occupied territories. Sorry to use that expression, but it helps to describe it. That over 5 years it would roll back, and so they're looking at a new lease on life. I think they haven't thought through a lot of the tough questions about actually building a nation state, landlocked, you know, with a lot of the issues that they have. But right now, a treaty to them looks, on paper at least, beautiful. And so there's a lot of support. The only ones who would be against the treaty right now are the far right, or the Hamas and so forth, who still harbor this dream of getting back all of...
So I want to respond. And I'll tell you the impression that I get from Israeli newspapers. Again, I don't know what's true. But the impression Israeli newspapers give me is that just as there is a large number of Israelis, perhaps even the majority, that are extremely wary of a possible peace treaty and want to put off the possibility of signing one as long as possible, Israeli newspapers give me the impression that there's an equal number of Palestinians, you know, 40, 50, 60%, that are very, very wary and afraid to sign a peace treaty because a peace treaty is about giving up. It's about concessions, and neither side wants to make concessions when they are certain that they're not going to get anything from the concessions. So you're talking to the peacemakers. And it could be these really newspapers,
and
of course, want to give you the impression that
the
Palestinians are against.
There's the group that Fatah all about the nation state. So I'm talking to them as well. Last thing I said, there is also a growing movement in Palestinians who are starting to say, forget this two-state stuff, let's move towards a one-state in which everyone in all of the land would have the same equal rights under one government, whether it's a kind of a confederation, a kind of two states under one umbrella, or what have you. So there's other movements out there. Rick.
Rabbi, the question I have for you is kind of a more personal question. As someone who is an Orthodox Jew, a rabbi, coming into this season of your life where you are opening your heart to going beyond the status quo, in light of your faith, what has the response within you been as you've begun to establish these relationships and these contacts over the wall? Has your faith rejoiced within you as you experienced that? Has it been a, you know, what's going on inside relative to who you are as an Orthodox Jew?
Expansiveness, widening of horizons, joy at becoming larger, expanding my narrative. It's a unbelievably enlightening journey. But that's just me. In other words, I don't know. Every personality is different. My personality is such that I see life and faith as a journey towards expansiveness. The more truths you can include, the more colors in the kaleidoscope of light, the more people, the more ideas, the more religions, the more cultures that you can include and see them as part of a grander truth, the more godlike you become. But that's my problem, that I have this crazy ideology.
Amen.
Oh, but are you a practicing rabbi? Do you give sermons on the Sabbath? Do you give sermons?
I do not have a congregation.
Oh,
and the truth is, I've never had a congregation. In Christian terms, I have a ministry. What that means is I have my own nonprofit. In Dallas, Texas, I am the educating rabbi for the whole community.
Oh, so then you can talk to the people in Dallas, Texas, that you're connected with about your feelings.
I do. They know. They know.
Okay. All right.
Thank you. I was really amazed.
By the way, I love his accent.
He's from Brooklyn, too. When I was in Israel, everybody was from Brooklyn. I got through the lines quicker than John. It was obvious why. Anyway, what was really amazing hearing you speak is how isolated the various groups are, that you didn't know your neighbor a few feet away. My first impression when I was in the Holy Land, the observations that I was able to make being there a very short period of time is that there was no communication. And that was kind of amazing, because I was also amazed how small the area is. What we call, or what is considered a valley in Israel, would be a gully in America. And you got to take some thought how small that area is, and how tiny it is across the center.
Yeah.
I mean, you could just walk it in a day, I guess. So if there's so little contact with the adults, don't you think it's time to work with the children? See, that's what I'm thinking. I hope I'm wrong, but maybe an entire generation is kind of lost if they're not speaking to each other. They don't know each other. And maybe when opinions are formed as adults, they're much harder to change than when children are getting opinions. Is there anything underfoot to have Arab kids and Israeli kids go to the same schools? Because when we were in Jerusalem, we saw the difference between the Israeli schools and the Arab schools. And I think our guide was saying how he'd love his kid to be in a school similar to the Israeli kids.
Yeah, thank you. So I think that you guys are going to be blown away by my answer, because even this is complicated. So look, there are a small number of combined schools like that in Israel within the Green Line. And these schools are run totally by people who define themselves as quote-unquote secular, whether the Arabs or the Israelis. In Judah and Samaria, the West Bank, the occupied territory, whatever you want to call it, the vast majority of the Jews there are religious, observant, dedicated to Jewish tradition. And the truth is the vast majority of Muslims are religious Muslims. For there to be schools that bring together Jewish children and Muslim children under the circumstances in which both communities are deeply rooted in their faith tradition, most people would see it as a disaster, as a tragedy. Now let me go back. When John and I were at this gathering of Palestinians and Jews a few days ago, there were some kids there, little kids, 4 years old, five, six, seven. And when the adults were sitting around, one of the Jewish women said to the whole circle, I don't know if you heard this, perhaps she said it in Hebrew, she said that her little boy just came up to her and said, Ima, mother, you should have taught me Arabic, because I don't know Arabic and I can't play with that kid. I want to play with him. And she said, wow, that's great. I should teach my kid Arabic. I'm certain if I would tell that story to my neighbors, to my family, to my wife, they would say, God forbid we should teach our kids Arabic, because God forbid our kids should play with the Arab kids. God forbid. Because if they would play together, they might become friends. And if they might become friends, they might fall in love and they might intermarry. You have to understand that the Jewish people have been a persecuted minority for 2,000 years. You have to understand that we suffer with the trauma of the Holocaust, in which we lost 6 million people. From a Jewish perspective, remember, Judaism is not just a faith, it's not a religion, it's a nation, it's a people, it's a family. From the Jewish perspective, intermarriage, when a Jewish person marries a non-Jewish person, is a tragedy. It's a loss. It's the end of the line. It's a tragedy. And Israelis look at the situation of Jews around the world and they say to themselves, thank God we don't have intermarriage. Of course, why don't we have intermarriage? The only people we can intermarry with are enemies. So God, thank God there are enemies, so there's no contact. What I'm saying is, and you actually your question opened up a very big matter here. The Arab-Israel conflict actually, in a very, very perverse fashion, has done a great favor for the Jewish people. Many Israelis say in hushed breaths, God forbid, what will happen when there's peace? Then we'll have to deal with the issue of potential intermarriage, and that just might be the end of the Jewish people. I mean, I just revealed to you a whole different level to the things that are happening here. So it's really complicated. I really, really, really want my kids to love, to get to know, to respect their neighbors, and in this case, my grandchildren. At the same time, I know there are dangers involved there. I personally am in favor of it. I don't know anyone else in favor of it. I don't even know too many rabbis who are in favor of Jewish children, religious Jewish children, going to school with secular Jewish children. We have separate schools in Israel, religious people and non-religious people. The government has two different school systems. So we're very Orthodox Jews, religious Jews, observant Jews are even very uncomfortable, and I want you to understand that it's a legitimate fear, uncomfortable of our children even studying with other Jews. And now you ask me, sitting with Arabs. It's really important, and it's really problematic, and it's really difficult. Now you see how complicated this stuff is. I don't have the power, thank God. I hear what you're saying. I hear.
Okay. With that, we promise you all we will stop sharply at 9. We could probably go on to 10 or beyond, but we do need to bring it to a close. Thank you all for coming. Thank you, Hanan, for being here. I really appreciate you.